Welcome, Lindsay and Arthur, to studio. It's great to have you here. To start, I know recently there was a Morningstar COP28 media debrief that laid out some, well, for me, some stark warnings about where we're at the minute. I think just to open, before we go on to, I think a good place to start would be both of your wish lists from the perspective of the work that you're doing in Morningstar with COP28 in mind. Morningstar data recently showed that at least 87% of companies are on a pathway towards a global temperature rise of 2.1 degrees Celsius. And I suppose, depending on whatever your point of view is, and I mean, it's just a here point of view, you know, is this red alert warning? And so I suppose with that in mind, maybe Arthur, could we start with you? Your focus is on regulation and what governments should be doing. So looking at COP28, what's your wish list? What do you want to see? And then what are your expectations? And then from the stewardship point of view, if we could answer the same.
Yeah, so I look at things mainly from a regulatory point of view. So COP28 is this huge international thing that goes way beyond my work remit. But I think what investors need, and our community, our clients and us, is consistency, right? You need consistent messaging. You can't deviate from it. We're trying to, sell a cargo ship, or I don't know what's the appropriate size, but you can't just switch direction from one COP to another. So consistency in general, policies that are rolled out in local jurisdiction as a result of those agreements, like the EU Green Deal, the US Inflation Reduction Act, are super important frameworks that give a certainty to investors that they are with the trend and the trend is their friend, and they need to have this support. They can't do it by themselves. So I think that would be the number one wish. And then from a technical regulatory point of view, I would say at a high level, we're now in the phase of implementing some of the standards for climate reporting, ISSB, et cetera. And it's really no time to have cold feet, around pulling the trigger and actually implementing and enforcing those disclosure rules. And here there is, I can deep dive into, what's happening at a global scale, but the results are a bit mixed bag, and we're a bit worried about certain jurisdictions deviating from the ISSB standards.
Where in particular, and in what kind of a deviation?
Yeah, so I mean, we all know that without Scope 3 emission, you can't really assess what's happening, even though there's, technical implementation difficulties associated with Scope 3. We don't want to ignore that, but without it, you're almost in the dark, right? So, seeing the the ECC mentioning several times that the Scope 3 could be out of the scope of their own standard, that's worrisome, I would say. Not a surprise, but not helpful, right? If you want to assess things holistically, and US companies are of course super important in portfolios of investors, so it's like it's an issue, and there's way to alleviate that. We have our modeling system, but you want as much as possible to have raw data coming from issuers, coming from them, being eventually subject to audits or limited assurance at the beginning. So, in the EU, it's going relatively well. We have the so-called CSRD, Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, with a dedicated climate standard that's fairly robust. There's been a last-minute attempt to derail this, but it was preserved. So,
What way was
it? In the European Parliament, it was a resolution to try to vote it down, and it was pushed back, and it made it through. So, but it shows that it's not an easy thing, and when you come to the finish line, sometimes policymakers have second thoughts. So, here in the UK, we already have the TCFD recommendation being applied by a large chunk of issuers. So there's already a standard out there, but the timeline to endorse ISSB, which goes a bit beyond TCFD, the first report will only be issued by 2026. So it's been, the timeline is not ideal. It could have been endorsed at an earlier stage, let's say. So it's mixed bag, I would say, on that front. And then the third point I'd like to make is not looking at the data, but looking at the rules that applies to our client investors, I feel like sometimes in the EU, the fight against greenwashing has caused regulators to lose sight a bit of climate. So they've developed a lot of data points that they've constructed, and some of them are not necessarily around climate. And this has led to sometimes confusion. For instance, they've created this label, US Paris Aligned Benchmark, and that's been tracked by a lot of funds, and they have significant amount of asset under management. And those funds have been asked to be classified as Article 8 and an Article 9 and an Article 8. Again, there's been lack of clarity and this fear of being on the wrong side of regulation and litigation doesn't help. And it's a very concrete example. It's the only label created by regulators, and yet they were not giving the highest qualification to the funds applying for those labels. So if you're Article 9, you're supposed to have a sustainable investment objective. You're supposed to be like, it's the highest classification, so to speak. And they were, because of legal uncertainty, they had to opt for Article 8, which is a safe option, which is to say, I'm just trying to fulfill ESG, or I'm just seeking ESG characteristic there. So
why is this? This feels like, I suppose, does this feel like governmental backtracking in a sense? Like, on one hand, you know, you've got incredible strides are being made with, you know, things like the IRA and, you know, equivalent, you know, Green Deal pledges and regulations being pushed through, you know, soaring demand for EV cars. We're seeing enormous strides in one sense, but then there's this kind of hesitancy, or one foot in, one foot out in a sense, in terms of the policy. I suppose what's spurring that? Is there a kind of a competing, like there's so many emergencies happening at the same time? There's some kind of sense of inertia? Are they scared of putting people off? What is behind that?
I think in the last examples I've mentioned, it's really that they were after perfect, and perfect is the enemy of good. So they really wanted like rules that were tight to protect retail investors and avoid greenwashing at all costs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people seeking climate objectives have been lost in this, you know, new rule book that's been a bit inconsistent and hard to read, and
paralyzed by this sort of wish for perfection.
Exactly. And the first example, sort of the second point around data, I think it's just people having cold feet just before pulling the trigger, and that's not helpful, I would say. I mean, the data gap's been identified for quite a while as a major hurdle for investors, and I hope that I'm wrong, and that the jurisdiction that are concerning will end up endorsing rules that are consistent with ISSB standard.
So I suppose, bearing in mind COP28, without being dramatic, feels like a kind of not a last ditch attempt, but a pretty crucial moment in to shift public opinion, to sway governmental will. Bearing that in mind, but, you know, looking at what you focus on, Lindsay, from the stewardship point of view, what is your, without, I suppose, just following the same format, what is your wish list? But what do you need to see happen from a stewardship point of view for the COP28 to be deemed in any way a success or be impactful?
That's the big question, really, I guess.
Possibly too broad of a question, but let's just...
No, it's quite all right. COP28 is absolutely a crucial moment, but it's the latest in a long series of crucial moments. COP27, COP26 have all been crucial. And I've written and spoken on the journey that we've been on in the last couple of years, where we go back to COP26 in Glasgow. There was this idea that finance was going to lead the transition, and there was all these... The GFANS was born, the Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative, the Insurance Initiative, Asset Owners. Lots of momentum around finance, lots of well-intentioned activity around that. And then I think in the 2 years since then, we're starting to see the limits of what private sector finance can do. Simply because there's been all these consultations. Arthur mentioned all the various regulations, CSRD, SEC climate rules still yet to be born, ISSB. The finance sector, asset managers in particular, have had to become very specific, going through all these regulations, figure out exactly what their response was going to be to this. And in that process, it's become very apparent what are the limits to the actions that they can take within the current global policy framework. So what's becoming increasingly clear is that finance's role is important in all of this, but it has to be led by a consistent global policy framework that enables transition and decarbonization and also adaptation. So we've seen the start of things like that with these, say, the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States and other various stimulus activities aimed at decarbonization, but it's not really been globally consistent.
You mentioned adaption before. You said there's a key. This you mentioned before. This was a key word to look out for at COP28. What do you mean by that? And you know, when you say adaption, why do you think this is going to be a key word? And what should you look out for? And what is the kind of significance of this term, like the idea of adaption, from your perspective?
Well, a lot of the focus has been on mitigation, on keeping the temperature rise as low as possible, well below 2, ideally 1.5. That's all well and good, but we're realizing now we're probably somewhere between 1 and 1.2 degrees, according to the science. We're realizing now that that's not as safe as we probably thought it was before. We say that anything below 1.5 is safe, but there's still a lot of changes that you're going to need to deal with. Mm. We've seen these droughts, floods, fires.
The extreme weather extreme, of this year yeah, is extreme not weather. Safe.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's still going to need to be a response to that, even if by some miracle we are successful in hitting 1.5, and it doesn't look like we will be. We'll get onto that, I guess.
Mm.
There's still a lot of capital and a lot of policy and a lot of effort that's going to need to be put into making operations, populations safe from the changes that we've already baked in, as it were.
You touched on something there about, you know, the targets and it looking unlikely that, you know, 1.5, it will be, you know, that the goal of 1.5 can be stuck to. And I suppose there is a fear that if you start to deviate from that, when to stop and how much complacency can set in across the board. What's your view on that? If both want to kind of give, I don't know, your thoughts on, if it's not realistic, shouldn't we just say it? Just say 1.5 isn't going to happen. But then what are the risks? And then what does your role fit into in this when it comes to dealing with companies? Can you, like I say, imagine a scenario where they say 1.5 is not going to happen. Let's just change it. How would that realistically work? And how do you manage
it? It's one of the 9 planet boundaries. So you cannot change that as an objective. That's the way it is as backed by science. So
when Hortense had sorry to cut over you. I remember Hortense mentioning at your COP28 debrief late last week, it will be a tragedy to hear that the target of 1.5 dies in Dubai. What is the sentiment behind that fear if it can't change them, I suppose?
I think the point is that all of the finance sector, all of the investment sector companies, they set ambitious targets that they will miss all the time. The target is to keep people on track for what the actual goal is, which is temperature reduction. And having that well below 2 degree target or the 1.5 degree target that we've had in recent years has managed to get us from a scenario where we were on track for 4 degrees of temperature rise, and it looks like we're on track for somewhere between 2 and 3 degrees. Now, between 2 and 3 degrees is still a problem. Let's not make any bones about that. However, that we've still had that progress because of having the ambitious target. If you relax the target at a time when we need more effort than ever to at least try and hit or at least limit temperature rise to the maximum amount we can, people start to slack off. We miss the less ambitious target, and then we're in an even bigger problem. And I think that's the key fear that I think Hortense was mentioning at the roundtable the other day.
I think the ECB published their second climate stress test, so you can look at the result, and they're showing the impact. Banks are a mirror, like they're a mirror of the economy, right? So they're a very good proxy. The amount of stranded assets, that procrastination will be more costly in general. So, I mean, there's again, going back to the first point, 1.5, that's the limit, that's the planet boundary limit. You know, you can change the goalpost, but like the reality is, it is what it is, right?
Sure.
So, and then it will just be more costly. So there's no commercial business incentive to wait to transition. Of course, it comes with political compromises, and as a policy policy leaders need to bear that into account, how much can be absorbed and taken in by society. But those two facts are undeniable.
Mm.
That's the planet limit, and the more you wait, the more costly it will be.
I'm interested as well, I suppose, looking at that, I suppose everyone's wondering, say, what this year is, I don't know, rabbit out of the hat moment will be. Last year, it seemed to be the loss and damage fund, which the blueprint of which I think has to be signed off in this summit now in the next couple of weeks. The loss and damage fund, I mean, as it's set out now, looking at the blueprint as it is now, is that enough? And if you were to say, not to make it kind of, not to be too much of a crystal ball question, but what kind of headline announcement could be made this year? Is there any kind of inkling, any ideas about what could be the COP28 big reveal or the big pledge by the asset management financial community?
It's hard to say what the rabbit out of the hat will be this time around. I don't think if you'd asked the same question this time last year that we would have expected the loss and damage fund to be the big headline. So it's hard to know. I think from my perspective, a big rabbit out of the hat would be some commitment to existing targets and frameworks. Whether it will be enough, it's hard to say. Everything has to start somewhere, and we know that there's trillions and trillions of dollars that we're going to need to pour into adaptation. So every element that we get towards doing that will help. But whatever number is announced for the loss and damage fund is probably not going to be seen as enough for particularly what developing countries have to do to adapt and transform their economies to deal with climate change. But every bit helps. I think that the key thing is that having promised the loss and damage fund at COP27, it'll be good to see some actual funding this year.
Because it's yet to kind of take off. The blueprint has to be agreed. So it actually hasn't started to work yet.
Absolutely. There's a lot of work to do. Last year's big announcement was a promise to set up a fund, not an actual fund. So, there's plenty still to be worked out.
Okay.
Just on that fund, and sorry to go back to the regulation, but last year I was asked, you know, what do I think about what's needed from a regulatory point of view? And it's still very much valid. And it was about this idea that, you know, of course, you know, money is needed, but also regulation is an extremely powerful tool. So the EU has developed their taxonomy. You probably have heard of it. It's centered around climate mitigation, climate adaptation. And everybody has to disclose that. So there's a strong incentive to disclose the highest figures and invest towards activities that are taxonomy aligned. This tool is completely useless abroad. It's full of EU regulation references. You don't know how to use it abroad. You cannot use estimates. If you do, you have to justify it with the regulators, and it's so constraining that you cannot use it abroad. So if if the EU wants to, or regulators want to take the lead, they should also look at their own regulation that is creating, that is protectionist de facto. If they want to build a bridge and help capital being deployed at global level, whoever needs it most to finance climate adaptation activities, they should take a look in the mirror and try to fix those issues. We're part of, not myself, but some colleagues of the Sustainable Finance Platform with the EU, but also a high-level expert group trying to help low and middle-class income countries have a framework that's more cohesive and coherent with sustainable investing. You know, the EU could help a lot by fixing those issues. It's not just money, it's also regulation. This can be a powerful tool.
Okay.
Sorry, coming from the regulatory nerd.
You are absolutely allowed to talk about regulation. Just kind of moving, it's sort of tied on to the idea of shifting public opinion and getting everyone on board. We know that, I suppose, they're very complex casualties to do with, you know, climate change. It's not like stop smoking campaign, you know, like smoking causes lung cancer. There you go. People get it. It's a completely different ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask about the hosts, the fact that it's, you know, an oil-rich UAE country. Is the UAE considering, you know, they're announcing, you know, like a new gas pipeline, you know, this year? Can an oil-rich country or oil-rich state such as the UAE really be the one to lead the messaging and on the kind of the very vigorous climate change action that we need now? Either one of you can jump in straight away and answer this one.
I think there was a lot of talk about that and very valid discussion over whether a nation so dependent on fossil fuels can lead in this. But I think it's important to remember that globally, it's an entire system that involves the fossil fuel sector, the finance sector, the corporate sector, that all need to work together. And so the idea that the United Arab Emirates should not be part of that conversation is pretty problematic. It's been decided they're taking the lead, they're doing what they can. They have their own idea of what transition should look like. I think it's important for the rest of the world to come together and find out what they can all agree on to drive towards 1.5 degrees rather than arguing about whether this nation or that nation is best placed to deal with it. Because you could perhaps have made the same argument about the UK hosting it with being a global finance center that is pretty dependent on the fossil fuel sector, on the material sector, on highly climate exposed sectors.
I agree that not having them involved is the idea of just not having them involved on that base level is problematic. But I suppose, you know, looking at if this is like a one in a number of key moments to try and kind of break away from what is essentially like a global addiction to fossil fuel. And then looking, I suppose, you know, like media reports on COP28, the kind of the merging of the interaction between the UAE's involvement with COP28 looks a little unusual. People have pointed it to being a little bit unusual. They've got kind of oversight of things in ways that maybe they shouldn't, or, you know, there's kind of a slight conflict of interest. I think at that point, maybe, I suppose you're right, it's really important to be specific if you're going to voice concern about it, as opposed to they have oil, they're the UAE, that's bad. You know, when it comes to the perception of this summit is so important. And then, you know, is this a concern? You know,
it is important. And I'm not aware of the details of the specific charges that have been leveled here. But if we are complaining about fossil fuels and lobbyists turning up in the UAE, well, they haven't just turned up for the first time, I think is a key point here.
Gotcha.
And so there are always those concerns. They're amplified quite rightly by the location of this year's conference, but you could probably level the same charge at several previous conferences, which is why we're not making quite enough progress. But I think it's time to move on from the conversation about where this is being held and focus on what we're going to do.
Okay. And on that, you're saying I understand it's proxy voting season. Could you kind of go into what that's telling us about the mood, I suppose, you know, the mood in the room from what you can see in this current proxy voting season as regards, you know, the shift that we need to see? What is the kind of the room, the temperature in the room at the minute?
Yes, well, it is proxy voting season only for me in that I'm analysing the results of what happened earlier in the year. I think what we're seeing is there are increasingly specific resolutions being filed, particularly in the United States, in terms of what, you know, high ambition investors want in terms of climate, which is resulting in lower support that mainstream asset managers do not necessarily feel it is their job to be as specific as these proposals mention on climate activity. Does that mean that they are less committed to climate change? I think it would be oversimplistic to reach that conclusion. As Arthur mentioned, we've seen a lot of regulation that now deals with the policy framework around setting transition plans and climate targets. And so as those regulations start to kick in, there is less and less need for individual proposals dealing with climate change. And so we've seen that effect start to kick in. Asset managers are more and more reluctant to support shareholder proposals on climate that deal with the minutiae of addressing climate change when those are already being dealt with by regulation. And we've seen CSRD, the European Sustainability Reporting Standards, ISSB, the SEC climate rule, when that eventually comes out, but we've also seen a new regulation in California that's dealing with those. So there's a lot of regulatory activity, which somewhat reduces the need for shareholder proposals on climate like we saw in 2021. What we are seeing, though, is there is an increasing focus from asset managers on climate risk governance, ensuring that the right people and the right risk management frameworks are being embedded in companies to deal with climate change, and a lot more focus on the political influence angle with regard to climate. So climate lobbying, requests for more disclosure from companies around those areas. That's largely in the United States. In Europe and other parts of the world, we're seeing more and more say on climate votes. I think that probably peaked last year rather than this year. We've seen fewer of them this year. But asset managers, investors, asset owners are applying a slightly higher level of scrutiny to companies' transition plans and reporting than they did before as they become more familiar with the territory. So we've seen a slight decrease in the level of support that management teams are getting for those plans. And I think that's a healthy development if people are becoming a bit more demanding in what they're expecting from companies' disclosures in that area.
Perfect.
Do you know, and before I let you go, and as I will say, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a very useful chat for me. I don't know if this is a fair question, but it's going to be the last question. So let's just see how it goes. If you were to be, it's a hypothetical, but if you were sat in front of the head honchos of the COP28, the most influential people in COP28, what is one ask, one plea, one command, I don't know, that you would say to them before it starts? It can be dream, it can be wish list.
I think it'd be
it can be direct. You don't have to be polite.
I think it would be to bear in mind that decarbonization that happens now is much, much, much more valuable than anything you plan to do in the late 2020s, in the 2030s, in the 2040s. There has been a lot of talk, not unjustifiably, about the potential for carbon removal solutions and offsets and their role. And that's all fine. There is definitely a place for that in the conversation. But it slightly detracts from the question, what are we going to do right now? Because avoided carbon now is much more impactful than whatever we could do to remove it in the future. And I think that's what people need to focus on.
Good point. Arthur?
I guess my message would be, the longer you wait, the harder it's going to be. And the harder it's going to be for your constituencies, right? They're elected political leaders. So no time to waste.
Get going.
Yeah.
It's the message.
Absolutely.
Well, Lindsay, Arthur, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.